This episode of The Bladder Presents is brought to you in part by Best Fiends, by Feels, and by listeners like you. Thank you so much for tuning in, and keep an ear out for promo codes later in the episode. And that episode starts right now.
It all went okay, didn't it?
Well, he took me to two bodies when I wasn't expecting him to even take me to one, so... yeah, you could say it all went very well. But you could also say that it went very, very, very fucking badly.
Could you ever? There'll always be an England. We're talking about two scripted takes on a couple of its headline cases today, starting with ITV's A Confession, in which Detective Steve Fulcher solved two murders by stretching the UK's version of Miranda until it snapped in his face. Then we'll be looking at the role that made a name for Christopher Eccleston when we look at his turn as Derek Bentley in Let Him Have It. It's like a battle of the Midsummer Murder stars up in here for The Bladder Presents, episode 143. Welcome back to The Bladder Presents, a podcast that tries to find the true crime that's worth your time. Joining me in leaving these United States, if only figuratively, is returning guest Allison Lohuff. Hello again, Al.
Hello. I was going to say it's so mean to be talking about England right now because that is where we were supposed to go as a family for spring break this year.
And
it was canceled. Because
if I'd realized I was torturing you in this manner, I would have picked some French or German case.
I mean,
instead.
I would even be glad to go over there and get murdered like these people were. So just for something to do.
Yeah, it's come to that. What are we on? Week 90 beige?
Yeah.
This? Yeah. All right. Well, let's get into the even cheerier subject matter at hand, shall we? Our most wanted section. We are talking about A Confession, which aired on ITV last fall and is coming to BritBox, I believe, as you're listening to this, it arrived yesterday. I'm going to throw a spoiler warning in here. The case is a real one and a matter of public record, but our discussion will contain spoilers as to various outcomes, so if you don't want to know, skip ahead. Here's the case file from the BritBox PR team's email to me, quote, Detective Steve Fulcher is brought in to piece together the last movements of a 22-year-old girl. However, when his investigation ties into a similar missing persons case and a prime suspect emerges, he is pushed to make a choice between following police protocol and getting justice for two grieving families seeking closure. The case made headlines in the UK as Fulcher's choice became just as big of a story. Even though he caught a dangerous criminal, his decision ultimately impacted his career and his personal life. While controversial and potentially unethical, it begs the question of, if it was your child in this situation and the officer was faced with the same circumstances, what would you want him to do? End quote. You can tell I didn't write this because it uses impact as a verb, and actually what it does is raise the question, not beg it. Yes, I will die on this hill, any road. BritBox is the streaming service with the BBC/ITV content, and we will have a link to the page in the show notes. But as I said, as you're listening to this, it is meant to have dropped on BritBox yesterday, May 12th. I had really no familiarity with this case at all before watching this. And I'm not sure that prospective viewers shouldn't maybe do a little background research on what happens before they start watching. What was your feeling? Did you know anything about this case? And would you agree that research affects the viewing experience?
I had heard the name, Sean's name, the victim, one of the victims, but I did not know all the ins and outs of the intricacies of what had happened with the law and how everything that it became involved. You know, as I was watching it, I paused a few times and like reached for the Wikipedia, like, should I check this out? Because there are some moments in there where you don't quite grasp what's happening, and they're very they skim over a lot. So, you know, it wouldn't hurt to familiarize yourself. Although I felt like it was set up in a way that it was, I have mixed feelings about the whole premise that they did here with this, the style that they did this in. They did attempt to make it sort of a bit of a thriller, and it works fairly well in some ways. So if you want to watch it and, you know, try to guess what's going to happen, you know, it is entertaining in that way.
Yeah, that's true. I just sort of like got a basic grounding in the case. So I sort of knew where, like what outcomes we were driving toward on various levels and like on various signposts. But mm-hmm. I think they do a good job. They sort of set you up at the beginning in two different timelines. Mm-hmm. First with Sean O'Callaghan, and then Becky sort of comes in later, even though it was happening earlier. And as well, you have really fantastic performances from Martin Freeman as Fulcher. Imelda Staunton is Becky's mother. Becky's father, who winds up being sort of a thorn in the family side, is played by, I don't remember the actor's name, but he was such a love in Bedrooms and Hallways, and then he's such a shit brick here that was a little disappointing. Yeah. And of course, Siobhan Finneran of Happy Valley and Downton as Sean's mom. She's really perfect in this role, and I think that the show does a good job, although sometimes a bit rushed through. Mm-hmm. Sometimes at really sitting with the idea that a murder happens to everyone around the victim also, and that there's a blast radius. You called for a clip featuring Ms. Finneran. Do you want to set that up at all, or shall we just hear it?
Let's hear it first.
All right.
Hello? Pete? No, no news.
Oh, shit. Well, there could still be any number of explanations.
No, there can't be. Nothing makes sense other than someone's got her, so let's just keep it real, please. We've been asked to do a press conference. All sat there begging for her life.
You've got to do it.
I know.
You have to get the message out. She's missing.
I know. We have to be that terrified family. Maybe one of us will cry on cue.
Oh,
it's
Pete.
So sad. They, Pete. I got a lot to say about Pete, but they, it nods to, you know, the cliche of these things. Like, this is a British murder mystery thriller. It's a true story being dramatized, but it still is hitting the tropes, I guess, which are cliches for a reason. And one of them is the crying family on the public appeal, which they have been asked to do, and that they, the real family, did when their daughter Sean went missing. And it, I mean, like, Siobhan Finneran, like, she's untouchable really in everything. And in this, just every time she was on screen, she was so magnetic as like this frayed person who was holding it together despite all this, you know, nightmarish stuff happening.
Well, that there's just no, you know, there's that like, not double-edged sword, but like, they are cliches for a reason, and you would think that there's like a template for what to do and how to be in the situation, but in her performance she makes it clear that you know, everyone is just sort of wandering mm-hmm. in the, you know, wandering in the desert of grief on their own, which is how she ends up attached to Pete, who is this like just perfectly realized, controlling wad. That performance is really amazing.
It is. And they, It's totally secondary to everything that's going on. That's what I found really fascinating about this. I wondered if they had filmed more of the, if they had gone deeper in the family stories and then like, let's just pare this down, you know, to where you get the basics.
I wondered the same thing. Like, how much of this did they shoot? Because as you get, as you continue into deeper into the series, you get this sense that like, you're seeing like fewer and fewer sort of dispatches from the family and seeing what's going on. And like, there's a whole summit meeting with the family where she's like, well, we're going to, you know, I've decided to give in to Pete and we're going to get married. And all the kids are kind of like,
yay,
cool and a question mark. Like, we want you to be happy.
Right.
Him?
Exactly.
And then they're at the wedding and he's peeing all over.
Oh my God. He was, speech. He truly was like unbelievably just a dick and like so selfish. But you see that from right from the beginning, because like this woman's, you know, this is his girlfriend, his daughter's missing. I mean, her daughter is missing. And he's like, well, gotta go. And then he's like, oh, she's still missing. Like, I wondered if they were trying to like trick us into thinking that he had something to do with it. And then I would remember like, oh, wait, no, this really happened. And I don't think that he was the one responsible. So there were a lot of little twists and turns, or feeling, and like, I don't know if they were just notes that I was feeling because I watched so many British mysteries, but I was, you know, these beats were happening where I thought, oh, they're trying to nod, you know, they're trying to like lean this way. And then I thought, well, wait, this really happened. Why would they do that?
Yeah.
I guess yeah. It's, you know.
Well, there, I mean, there was one moment where, fucking Inspector Lindley is playing QC. And I thought,
I screamed,
like,
Lindley.
I was like, yeah, me too. Like, my notes even screamed. It was in all caps, but I was like, kind of like not half paying attention, but I was listening versus watching. And I was doing something on another screen. And I was like, wow, like they're really going for the Lindley reference here by casting a guy who sounds like Lindley. And then I paused it. I'm like, that motherfucker is Lindley. Amazing. Yeah.
And he still looks great.
Yeah.
Even in a wig. Yeah.
Even in that little wig, I still would. Uh-huh. Yeah.
Wouldn't hesitate. But no. The thing is, like, there's only 10. There's only 10 British actors, and they're all in this.
Yeah, they
the
sure
10,
are.
The 10 best. And it, I mean, really, when you think about the premise of the idea, it's like this series of reenactments like that are like Ion level, like Discovery mystery level. But then they cast like the most prestige actors to play these reenactment people. And this was the result. And like,
yeah,
even the beginning
like,
of it felt like it was being shot on somebody's phone. Like it even had that quality to it. I think it got better for me as it went along, but it was kind of like rushed. It felt like, I don't know how to describe it.
I mean, I think it did certain things really well to the point where I wouldn't have minded another couple of episodes to let the story sort of dig into itself, given that this was like a proper TV series that each episode is 45 minutes and there are certain constraints there.
Mm-hmm.
But it's like, I don't know, like let the story dig into the parts with the family in the aftermath or the boyfriend who sort of has to come and tell the mom, like, you know, I still really miss her and everything, but I'm seeing someone else.
Right.
And how everyone is going to deal with that. Like, I have to think scenes were shot with the boyfriend, like debating with himself or their roommate or whatever, like, well, how am I going to tell her? When am I going to tell her?
Right.
And we didn't
see
that. Or
just struggling emotionally with it. Yeah.
Yeah. At the same time, I did think that if they erred on the side of showing us less, that was smart, because this is one of the few, like docudramas or dramatizations of something real where when you're seeing these flashbacks, they're kept pretty short.
Mm-hmm. Thank
and
mercifully.
Elliptical, and maybe it's that you're often in the hands of Imelda Staunton.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe it's that I feel like United States programming really feels the need to heavily underline how horrible it is to be related to an addict. It's like, I mean, I think we all know.
Right.
At this point, the outline of that by now.
Yeah.
But I thought those were very effective. I thought they gave us enough processy stuff. Like, there's one point where they, you know, their prime suspect is a taxi driver. So they send someone for a UC pickup, and these undercovers are having a, quote, casual conversation with each other and the driver about this news bulletin, which the cops have also carefully placed on the radio for a given time, so that they're just like rattling Halliwell's cage. And it's pretty interesting to see it in action. So here's clip three.
Police revealed earlier today that they have narrowed down the search area dramatically and no longer need the public's help. A pilot who suffered a heart attack...
Heard that they're about to arrest someone. Isn't that what that policeman said, Ray? Yeah.
What policeman?
Well, we've had our car next. Well, getting bloody taxis everywhere. They talked to his copper when he came to the house.
Say it's just a matter of time.
Yeah, and then there's like an extremely close-up of Halliwell being like, gulp. So
right.
I thought that was good. There are often shots, like, I'm so tired of drone shots in true crime programming, but I thought these were really good because when Fulcher is sort of struggling with himself and what to do with the suspect, because the sort of primary problem with the confessions that he got, which then like ended his career, mm-hmm. is that there is a proviso: if you really believe that the victim is alive and that it's a kidnapping, then you can take more liberties with like taking him back to the station and cautioning him, their Miranda, in other words.
Right.
So whether or not he actually believed this was the angle that he took to get the confession, not just of Sean's murder, but then Halliwell volunteers another one. And that was the crux of the problem.
Right.
But
it's such an awkward problem. Go ahead. No, it's just such an awkward problem that police have. It's so important to have those rights as someone who's accused. But then also, I mean, as he reiterates over and over again, he, in case she was alive, that was his chance to save her life. And then the guy just threw in a bonus dead body, you know?
Yeah.
So what was he supposed to do?
And then you have these drone shots of, first of all, the way that they shoot it, you really get a sense of this, like, everyone on the police side holding their breath. Mm-hmm. Because, like, the slightest breeze could prompt Halliwell to be like, fuck this, I want a solicitor, take me to the cop shop. But then there's also these big drone shots of the landscape and it's sort of like vastness and wild unsettledness mm-hmm. that underline the fact that if he doesn't get these confessions by whatever means and get him to take the cops to the bodies, they'll never find them.
Right.
Because it's the, you know, they're needles in a big haystack. So I thought that was very effectively done. And the show also is fairly elegant about expositing without seeming like it's expository about what the issues at hand are. Perhaps it's the British accents that make me feel like it's so expertly done.
I think it's that and the caliber of the performers, because they do a lot of it, but you're okay with it.
Yeah. Well, and also, like, it's John Watson, like, you're accustomed to him just being like, here are the order of these unusual synapses. Anyway, here's clip four.
We always knew this could happen. We have an urgent interview script prepared, which I want carried out at the point of arrest.
Before we bring him back here?
Well, yes, we've still got absolutely no evidence that Sean is dead, and it's there in the kidnap manual. In situations like this, the life of the hostage comes before everything else. I want him to tell us where she is, not hide behind no comment.
All right, well done, Marty.
He's great. I mean, yes. he has a thing and he does it in everything. And it's very moving. Like, he has these little quiet little asides and moments, and sometimes you can't hear what he's saying, but it doesn't matter, I guess. But I mean, he carries it through. It's this, The Hobbit, The Office, everything. I mean,
Fargo.
You get what you are getting from him. And I mean, he's just, I think he's great. And he was great in this.
Yeah. There's a, this character, I think sometimes, and I don't know if this is the portrayal or this is really how Fulcher was, but there are times when you're like, well, you could try to explain yourself or apologize or fight a little harder, like when he's basically being suspended. Mm-hmm. And the superintendent's like, have I made myself clear? And he's like, yep. Hands over his badge. And this is where I was like, aren't you going to hand in your gun as well? Oh, right.
Oh, yeah.
You're a civilized country. But yeah, he's just like, well, you know, rightio then. Bye.
Right.
And then he goes home and he's like, just smoking in the house in his bathrobe.
Exactly.
His wife's like, I told you not to do that. And then she storms out of the room and he like relights it. Yep. I was like, he's like, okay. Seem fun.
I know. Yeah. He really... He has that inner thing where he's showing, without even showing it, the like stress ball that lives inside of him. But it's like there's no point in being anything but British about it, because what could he possibly do to change things, you know, that he hadn't already tried? So he's not going to get upset by any means.
Mm. Yeah. Also, he's British, so.
Right.
it wouldn't occur to him. Like, right. I'm going to, you know, sweep everything off this desk and slam the door. Like, no.
No, we don't do that.
That's in the American American remake. Yeah, no, he's great. Speaking of great, it's time for a word from our sponsors. I love talking and thinking about true crime, obviously, but even I need a break now and then. And for the past few months, my go-to mental palate cleanser has been Best Fiends. Best Fiends is a puzzle game that anyone can play. You don't need to be a hardcore gamer or anything, but despite the adorable graphics and sound effects, it is made for adults with challenging puzzles and ongoing storylines. Okay, there's storylines about collecting candy eggs and gold bars, but that's just the thing for these pandemic times, at least for me. Best Fiends is great for those in-between times. Waiting for soup to heat up, when the associate vice president of fire hydrants, aka your dog, is performing a lengthy neighborhood spot check, and if you have to quit in the middle, no worries. The game will remember where you left off and drop you right back in. And if your internet quits in the middle, no worries there either. You don't need Wi-Fi to play Best Fiends. You can play it anywhere, anytime. I've been playing it a lot lately to give myself a lightweight distraction from the headlines, but even on days when I burn through a bunch of levels, it doesn't get old. Best Fiends updates the game monthly with new boards and events. Engage your brain with fun puzzles and collect tons of cute characters. Trust me, with over 100 million downloads, this 5-star rated mobile puzzle game is a must play. Download Best Fiends free on the Apple App Store or Google Play. That's friends without the R, Best Fiends. Thanks, Best Fiends. All right, returning now to a slightly less fun and snuggly topic. A confession.
Yes.
Before Halliwell figures out that he can leverage Fulcher's procedural misstep to his own advantage.
Which, don't you wonder, like, how, like, what kind of idiot this guy was? Like, have you never watched any of these shows that we're watching now? Because it's a major thing.
But here's the thing, like, in the clip I'm about to play, this is a somewhat unusual vantage point from which to view perpetrators like this. So here's clip 5, and then I'll talk about that a little more.
What did you want to talk to me about?
I'm a sick fucker.
And the scene sort of goes on like that, where Halliwell is like, you know, there's something wrong with me. Do you think I could be fixed? I think that this is an unusual moment in procedurals of this type. You might see it more in non-American properties, but usually it's a pretty 1.5 to 2-dimensional portrait of like someone who is psychotic or a psychopath or just unrepentant, non-chaotic evil. Mm-hmm. And you don't ordinarily get, like, he's still a monster, but he is dimly aware of it and is sort of like sees this conversation as a chance to connect with someone about how he, like, he knows that what he's done is wrong.
Right.
And that's unusual. I thought that was interesting. And
it
then
was.
Once he's had some time to think about it in the Hoosegow, he's like, oh yeah, I fucked you over for revenge. Like, I don't think he didn't know that he was supposed to be cautioned. I just think he, A, didn't care in that moment, and B, decided that he would act like this was all part of his big plan to screw over the police when it really wasn't.
Yeah, he definitely came up with some big plans and stories and weird ideas that he thought were going to, I don't know if he ever thought they were going to be successful, but yeah, that was kind of a weird or an interesting moment. And it was very quick, you know, and he says something like, do you think there's any hope for me to be right, or, you know, to be fixed or whatever? And like Martin Freeman, you know, like swings his head around in that way, like, you know, like, maybe so. Where's that other body, you know? Yeah, it was interesting. It was like Halliwell, as much as the case was, you know, about him and, you know, his crimes, like, they don't spend a lot of time on, like, what possibly turned him into this person that did this and, you know, the depth of his depravity, or, you know, they show that he has daughters that are adults, and he tries to parlay his relationship with them into, you know, sympathy. And we could have used those extra episodes, like you were saying, and, you know, one on him would have been revealing, I think.
Yeah. I think what they give you is advised, because there's a sequence where they're watching the CCTV and he's like just buying a packet of crisps at a gas station or something, and he keeps putting what he's buying on her face on the wanted poster at the counter so he doesn't have to look at her. Mm-hmm. And they exposit about that a little bit, but this is also like, I think American TV might have dwelt on his pathology as though it really matters. Like, at a certain point, I feel like I say this a lot on this podcast, but at a certain point, it's like pointless to speculate about why, like, murder, like, right. They murder.
True.
And
they
even
have their reasons.
Couldn't really tell you why. So,
true.
Yeah. And what did you think of the fact that at one point they pull a bunch of clothes out of a pond, I guess, near where Becky's remains were found, but they can't really match them up to anything? What did you think about them kind of like leaving that?
Yeah, that was kind of a weird thing. They find this stuff and then they cut away from it and they come back another time and they find like Sean's, one of her boots that had gone missing, which they had not mentioned like until the very end. They're like, oh yeah, she was wearing boots. How did they come off? You know, because her family, they sort of used that to explain that they had kept a lot of the details of what happened to her from the family, because Halliwell originally pled guilty and did not have to reveal the details of his crime in court.
Right.
So when they find these clothes, they just sort of like, they're like, we found some stuff that may be related to other crimes that he's committed, and then sort of leave it sitting there. And I guess it was not resolved even to this day, if they're connected to other cases.
Yeah, I get the sense that Fulcher was more vocal about feeling that Halliwell had killed many more than just the two in real life than we see him being here.
Right. We don't see him have the opportunity really to make that point. I mean, he does say it, but, and that's why he's so frustrated. You know, one of the reasons that they're kind of pushing him around and how he eventually gets kind of railroaded. But yeah, they seem to, the wheels of justice are moving very slow for whoever these other victims may be.
Right. Well, and I have to wonder, I believe that this was adapted at least in part from his book, which is called something like Catching a Serial Killer. So you wonder if the screenwriter wasn't like, you know what, actually you are kind of a crackpot and this isn't helping.
Maybe.
Like, oh, a psychic medium now? Nah, I don't think so. All right, well, let's wrap it up with an appreciation of Imelda Staunton in case anyone was in any doubt. In this next scene, which I really would not put this in any other hands or direct anyone explicitly to do what she does here, but Staunton spends the whole series on this knife edge between like much too much. Not her performance, but like just this person who is completely preoccupied with this lost child who on some level she had knew and has been lost for some years already. It's extraordinarily sympathetic because it's so frequently like just off-putting and like just too close. To one in some ways. So yes. Here she is when Fulcher arrives to tell her the bad news at last.
They're enough now. Oh my goodness.
Calm down. It's probably the pigeon postman.
Okay. Here to speak to Karen Edwards.
I know why you're here.
Mrs. Edwards, can I come in?
Oh my God. It's my daughter, isn't it? She's a second girl. Oh my God. It's her press day today.
What's going on?
There's the police. They're to tell me that Becky's dead, aren't you?
Sorry, yes, I am.
No!
Oh,
my God!
Karen! Steve! Karen!
And that's how you end episode 3. Happy Mother's Day, everybody!
Oh, Lord, it was bad. But you know what? It was, like, very real. She's brilliant. I mean, like, you know, as you say, like, she's on the knife edge the entire series, even after she finds out her daughter was indeed dead and the one that was buried in the field. And, you know, to make this character, this person is a sort of, they're trying to show that she's like brassier than the other mom. And she's kind of like a little bit, not lower class, but like, as far as the hierarchy of class in England, like she's, you know, she's on the bottle blonde side and, you know, making Imelda Staunton that person is a big ask, but you know, she pulls it off and it's great. That was a brutal scene.
Yeah. It's, and then she has another scene later where she's sort of, rallying community support to keep the pressure on police to keep up with this case and to, like justice for Steve Fulcher basically, but also justice for Becky, who Halliwell does get sentenced for Sean's murder, but not for Becky's because that confession was thrown out. So,
right.
She and her family, and even after a while, her family is like, oh my God, we can't with this or you. But she gets up and is like, you know, it turns out that I really hate the sound of my own voice, and this is extremely awkward, but I'm doing it because someone has to, right, so that she's not forgotten.
The other thing about this character that Imelda Staunton plays, she's named Karen, and she sort of redeems all Karens because she is the pushy busybody who gets this case against Halliwell brought back. And even to the point where, even though she's the one who's thought less of because her daughter was troubled and a drug addict, and Sean, the other victim, was sort of like this upstanding girl in the community, Karen's, you know, sort of feels looked down upon, but she doesn't stop, and she even pushes and defends Fulcher, hero of Karen's.
Yeah, Karen's had a rough go lately, but she definitely clawed them partway back.
Yes.
With this. Yeah, so a confession, it's not a game changer, this series, but it's quite well built. It doesn't feel too long. Like, we've been talking about how we wanted more of some parts, like not really more of Pete, but like the part where she's like, we got to pack up while he's at work. I wouldn't mind seeing him getting home to seeing hangers swinging empty in the closet.
That would have been so nice, honestly.
Because he's the worst.
Yep.
The cast is uniformly outstanding. It was really a delight to be like, Lindley!
For sure.
And it does some things differently.
Yeah.
Which, when you watch enough of this shit, I think you'll agree that's enough.
It was refreshing, honestly, the style of it. It sort of kept me interested. I binged the whole thing. And I think it's worth watching just for the end when you see Halliwell's second trial, in which he, like a genius, defends himself and makes a complete cock up of it. And the judge in the trial is like, what? Why? Where? You know, it's just so, it's really good. So I did enjoy it a lot.
All right, moving on to our cold case. I'm not sure exactly why I picked this topic, except that it was also a headline British case, but from the middle of the previous century. We are contemplating Let Him Have It from 1991. Here's the case file from the IMDb. In 1950s England, slow-witted Derek Bentley falls in with a group of petty criminals led by Chris Craig, a teenager with a fondness for American gangster movies. Chris and Derek's friendship leads to their involvement in the case, which would forever shake the United Kingdom's belief in capital punishment. End quote. It took the UK a little longer after this to abolish capital punishment, but it's pretty easy to see how the Bentley case pushed the country in that direction, given the myriad questions around the case and its outcome, including, but not limited to, questions about Bentley's mental capacity and ability to understand the charges against him and assist in his own defense, about Bentley's culpability, since everyone seems to agree that it was actually Craig who shot the cop. The legal responsibility of accomplices meant that he, a juvenile, was out of jail in 10 years. Bentley got the rope. Questions of intent surrounding Bentley's hollering, let him have it, at Craig before Craig fired the fatal shots. The QC seemed to believe that he meant, you know, let him have it, like, fill him full of lead. And Bentley maintained that he was like, the cop had just asked for the gun, and he was like, let the cop have the gun. The movie seems to take that stance on things. We Americans still have questions about why we still have a death penalty when these same conversations routinely attend every execution in the States. But anyway, let's focus on the movie. Did you know anything about this case before we watched it?
I had heard of this case because of the capital punishment element, but I had not seen this film, and it was very good. I think it laid out the situation really well. especially starting like in with the childhood of Bentley and everything, it gives a really big picture of his life and how he ended up where he did.
Yeah, I agree. I had heard of this case. I had not seen the movie either. I went through I would call it a phase, but it was seriously like 2 decades where after Shallow Grave, which I just think is not a good movie and he is not good in it, I could not cope with Eccleston in anything. And then he was made a Doctor Who and I was like, bitch, bye.
Exactly.
And then he was in The Leftovers and it was such a like beautiful human performance that made him super sexy to me also. And now I love him. And you can see watching this, like every reason that Eccleston is like a revered actor is in this.
Yeah.
It's such a careful, not like shortcutty performance of this poor man child that I really thought it was great. I don't know what they were trying to do with his hair. Honestly. Well,
they were really making it the flop, you know, was trying to make that a significant character beat. But yeah, and then when it's like super blonde at the end, I don't know. But they were trying to make the hair super and very important for some reason. Yeah, he's amazing in this, and just he could have gone all kind of ways. You know, of course we don't know what the real Bentley was like, or I've never seen anything about, you know, his actual life and personality, but he makes him extremely sympathetic, and it's just such a pitiful story.
It really is. They also do an excellent job with like surrounding him with this loving family who in the end can't protect him from the merciless vicissitudes of sentencing law.
Yes.
In England at the time. And you sort of expect in a story like this that there's going to be this harshness to the family and particularly from the father. But the father, who I believe is played by Tom Courtney, mm-hmm. who is, I mean, again, another old home week of British actors, including my favorite midwife, Nurse Crane,
yes.
from Call the Midwife. And she doesn't even get any lines. I was so mad.
So weird.
I know. Justice for Linda. I recognized her immediately, though. His dad really is like the least, he's like a very un-mid-century British dad. Based on right. what we've been conditioned to expect from properties like this. Here's clip 8.
Educationally, Derek has not been progressing, and as you know, his fits have been getting worse. Taking into account his low intelligence and his epilepsy, we have decided he should be allowed home, even though it's highly unusual for a boy to be released so early in his sentence. It will be up to you to make sure he stays out of trouble.
He should never have been put here in the first place.
He was caught stealing tools.
Well, we've brought him up to tell the truth, and he told us he was just playing. Do you know what the magistrate asked him to do? He asked him to spell fluorescent. Fluorescent. I can't spell it, can you?
There's just the weight of trying to protect this boy who, through various probably traumatic brain injuries, though they didn't call it that back then, mm-hmm. was just somewhat afflicted or like left behind by the right. intellectual life, as my grandmother might have put it. and just the sort of the weight of like fearing for him and not really being able to protect him entirely or forever, I thought was really lovely and unexpected.
Yes. It is the, you know, you get a little nugget of information about the juvenile justice system there as well, where the smallest infraction can get you sent away from your family to a boys' home where you're not treated so great. And I guess even the headmaster of said school can't spell fluorescent. I don't know. Was that what we were, when he said that?
Yeah, I actually had to pause it. I was like, oh, yeah. That is kind of bullshit.
The guy looked at him like, well, I'm sure I can spell it, but, you know.
That's not the point. Isn't it, though? But, I mean, when even the headmaster of a state school for delinquents is like, right. Yeah, you got to take over.
Right.
We got nothing for this kid. And they also do, they spend a lot of time sort of, once he's sent back from the school, he becomes this recluse just with all of his pets. And his sister is always trying to get him to, like, come out and rejoin the world or at least open a window so he doesn't give his turtle lung cancer.
Right. The turtle's up to 20 packs a day or something.
Yeah. Yeah. Which she, I mean, I think she uses those words. And yeah. At first it's like, Craig doesn't even show up for like 18 minutes and you're spending all this time in his childhood. And this is definitely one where I would not read too much about the circumstances of the crime beforehand, because you may feel somewhat impatient, mm-hmm. but I think Let Him Have It is trying to say something about, again, here, the effects on families.
Yes.
Of contact with the justice system, capital punishment. And like, there's a scene at the end where everyone's just sort of like waiting for the hour to have passed. And when he's being escorted, like even the guards seem to really feel that this is not
right.
A sensible outcome. And when he's dictating that last letter to his parents and the guard just looks stricken by what he's writing down. It's really well done, like that they take the time to locate you in this family mm-hmm. that is loving and functional, and just if you're too impatient for plot to happen, which I was a little bit, I don't think you get the full effect of what the film's trying to do.
Right. Well, I made the mistake of, well, not knowing, but I watched this after I watched A Confession, which, you know, moves at super fast speeds where, you know, they don't spend a lot of time digging into anything. And this like really stretches out. Of course, it's a film, but it's set in the 50s. And so it's very warm and, you know, it's tells the story of this sad thing that this family, you know, was falling through their fingers. You know, they couldn't help this person that really needed help, their son. So,
and then he sort of fell in with a bad crowd, including this basically a prat, whatever, we're all 16, no judgments, but Craig, who like there's some kind of I had sticker trading at my school. They have like pistol trading before classes started at their school. And then this magnificent schoolmaster figure played by Murray Melvin. I'm sure we're supposed to think he's an abusive martinet. I think he's amazing and hilarious. I will be referring to things as Woolsey's for no reason. Clip 9.
A Woolsey. It's a long time since I've seen one of these. What have I told you about bringing guns in?
Not to, sir.
That's right. Again, I have to tell you, you've never seemed to learn. And what about bullets? I didn't tell you to shut your desk, did I? If you'd have fired this gun, you would have shot your head off.
And then he's just waving it around indiscriminately. Also, every time you hear a clank or like a clomp sound, that's him hitting a student in the head with a book, like a hardcover.
Right.
I mean, this is not how we do things anymore, but this no. performance, Mr. Melvin was like, I only get one scene.
Exactly. This, I'm making the most of this.
Oh my God. He absolutely did. Oh, Woolsey.
What have I told you about bringing guns
to school? Not to clonk. Okay. Yes, sir.
Imagine.
And he's wearing an academic gown and just flapping around like he does bear some resemblance to Palpatine, and he's wearing an academic robe. It's just the Britishest school scene that ever existed.
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, the texture of this is really something. And unlike a lot of 90s period movies, it really feels like it's when it feels like it was shot at that time more than the sort of like brightly colored, we're going to let everyone have the same hair.
Right. People are driving the same car. And
yeah. Or like, this like John Waters Fantasia where it's like, well, that actual time period isn't the point. Like, well, if you just wanted to wear a poodle skirt, just have that character have the affectation and don't set it in 1958. I don't know.
Right. Yeah. It's very, and rather than fall into a lot of cliches, you know, we're talking about the family, like they lived in town. They didn't live like out in the country on a farm or anything. And they had like this house full of animals, and it was just very, I don't know, personal, you know. They really made you feel like these people were real, which they were, but like it felt very warm and of the time.
Yeah, and lived in. Like, you really believe that these people, I don't know, sometimes it can just be a little bit like a screenplay will set up a family in the manner of a foosball row, and nobody really moves, or like they only move in one direction. And it's like, hello, I am the sister. You can tell because I have long hair. And
yes,
this actually really felt like these people knew each other and were related. And that sense of fond exasperation was well done. Speaking of fond but not exasperating things, it's time for another word from our sponsors. What is Feels? Feels is a better way to feel better. Feels' premium CBD will keep your head clear and help you feel your best. CBD has been proven to reduce anxiety, pain, and sleeplessness. And while I am prone to anxiety even in the best of times, the last couple of months have been not that. So the anxiety is ramped up for reasons obvious and less so. There's lots to do and lots to worry about. Feels has helped me do less worrying about worrying and focus on my multi-layered spreadsheet of to-dos, which, come to think of it, might be part of the problem. But anyway, if navigating the world of CBD seems as complicated as my Excel life, not to worry. Feels is there to help simplify the process with a CBD hotline that offers real human support on where to start and how to find the best dosage for you. And wherever you end up in that discovery process, Feels is a cinch to take. Just place a few drops under your tongue and you'll feel the difference in minutes. That's it. No titration or prep or anything. Feels works naturally and you won't feel any high or hangover, and you won't get addicted. Feels' hassle-free membership program is a cinch as well. Feels is shipped direct to your doorstep every month. Members save money on every order, and you can pause or cancel anytime you like. Feels has me feeling my best every day, and it can help you too. Become a member today by going to feels.com/blotter. You'll get 50% off your first order with free shipping. That's feals.com/blotter. BLOTTER, to become a member and get 50% automatically taken off your first order and free shipping. Feels.com/blotter. Thanks, Feels. And they won't make you spell fluorescent either. As far as the, I think the film does an excellent job giving you a sense of the people. How did you feel about it giving you a sense of the plot, like the timeline, the actual events?
I followed it pretty well. I thought that the crimes with Craig. Wait, is that his name?
Yeah.
Okay.
I think his first name is Christopher Craig, but yes, yeah, Chris Craig. Told me, never trust a guy with two first names.
That's very good advice.
Exhibit A.
So yeah, once he shows up on the scene, it picks up really quick. And I think it reels out the story in a nice way. It's a good movie.
Yeah, I think it is too. I'm a little surprised that it's not better known. I mean, I know it's almost 30 years old and people can kind of watch any old thing. It's not, unfortunately, you do have to rent it on Amazon. It's not free with Prime. But it also is not too judgmental about Craig sort of getting Bentley into this mess and then getting out after 10 years and going back to a law-abiding and quiet life, which Craig did do. The performance does point up that he's kind of a pretender and quite young. And when the shootout does get out of hand, you definitely feel just the confusion in situations like that. And especially when there's a 16-year-old involved, just like how quickly it can go pear-shaped.
Mm-hmm. And like, oh no, what have I done?
Yeah.
Yeah.
In clip 10, you hear the disputed, let him have it. And I think it, you know, Eccleston was no doubt directed to give it some ambiguity, but I think he is telling Chris to just let the cop have the gun. Listeners, you be the judges. Here's clip 10.
Don't say anything, all right?
He's got a gun.
Don't fucking move.
Come on, son, game's up.
Get back, cover!
Give that thing to me.
Let him have it, Chris!
Well, that didn't go as anyone planned, but you can hear Chris Craig like hyperventilating with dread, and then the cop is like, and then he points the gun at the cop. The cop's like, "Give me that thing,"
right? And it doesn't go well.
No, it doesn't. That's not even. I mean, he does shoot that cop, but that's not even the cop who dies,
right?
Mr. Nurse Crane enters the scene later, and then Chris Craig is sufficiently, I think this might have been like tuned up a little from reality, but he is sufficiently afraid of what's to become of him once he's cornered that he throws himself off the roof. This is a bum note, in my opinion, that the unintentionally humorous cartoon hollering as he is sailing very slowly off the roof and through a greenhouse roof.
Oh no.
It was like, yes. You know, I don't.
Well,
this is not okay.
Yeah, the character, Chris Craig, I have no problems with it. He was a bit cartoonish, but in that way that kind of kid is in real life. Like, he was wearing a fedora because of the period, but also, like, you get the impression that he'd be wearing one no matter when it was shot. He's a fedora kid. And like, he's obsessed with gangsters, and that's American gangsters. And that's how he got all this, you know, fantasy life that he was living out. So for that to be his over the greenhouse moment.
Well, and yeah, he has also an older brother who is kind of, he's in a gang or a crew, I guess, but the whole thing is just really like grimy and like even Donnie Brasco would be like, yeah, I don't need that shit. Like, it's really just low level stuff. So he aspires to be like his big brother, and when his brother gets locked up, it's this whole like psychological blight on his existence, and then he's trying to run his own little crew, and it's not cute, and this is what happens. No. But the fedora, definitely, that like even adults are like, what are you doing?
I know. And he's so, they really, I really did stop and laugh when he first meets Bentley. he's like a foot shorter than Eccleston. And it just sort of underlines the whole, like, this is a kid talking to a man with mental impairment, you know, and it's just, it's sort of a, just a sad situation.
There are several moments like that where you are reminded that, and, you know, despite the strictures, like, that inevitably you're shooting using, like, whatever, 21 or 23-year-olds to be 16 or 17. But the film does a good job reminding you periodically that these are children who sort of recognizable delays or not do not, like, the brain is not done growing.
Right.
There's one exchange where Bentley hears, overhears it, the results of some test that he was given after a series of his seizures. And it says that he's subnormal intellectually. Mm-hmm. And he's sharing this with Craig. And first of all, that he would do that. And there's that trust that he would share that with him where he knows he's not going to be made fun of. But Craig's response is, well, you're not normal, but you're not subnormal either.
Right.
Like, that was just such a, like, boy way to be about it. And then in our final clip, Bentley is being questioned as to why he took possession of a knuckle duster. But when Jersey over here says knuckle duster, it's one thing.
Exactly.
When an employee of the British court says it, it's rather another. Clip 11.
On the way to the warehouse, Craig gave you a knuckle duster.
Yes, sir.
Why?
I don't know, sir.
You do not know why he gave you the knuckle duster?
Then why did you take it?
And his response to this, I entirely clipped that because the very British knuckle duster, like, I would just like to give them a list of, like, Brooklyn and Jersey, like, terms, like, please say the word jabroni, and like, Scotland, say jabroni, Wales, say jabroni. I just would like to hear that.
Say, Angela, I'm going to get a slice.
If you're going to Mandaloking, where are you going? Down to the Jersey Shore. No, try it again. Down the shore.
They have their own Jersey to deal with.
They sure do.
Old Jersey.
Yeah. A famous original Jersey led by King Ray. But his answer right after that as to why he takes the knuckle duster is like, it was something that I never had before. It was something that was mine that I could keep, that I never had before, which was this very, like, he's in the dock in this gigantic zoot pale blue jacket, which he has to wear in jail, by the way, surrounded by various court clerks and judges in their long robes and the little wigs and everything. He still manages to look small, although Eccleston is a formidable size, particularly for an actor. And this childlike response, it's like, I don't know, I just wanted to hold it for him. Like, oh, right. God, like, you sentence this child to death? What?
To how? Hang. I know.
Yeah. This movie, I was kind of like, all right, well, we'll see.
Right.
But it wound up being quite affecting. And I also learned a couple of little things about the manner of death sentencing, I guess, in mid-century Britain, namely that someone comes over and puts a little black kerchief, like, perches it on top of the judge's wig before he pronounces the sentence, which is rather detailed as to how the sentencee's remains will be disposed of.
Right. The hanging judge, yeah.
Yeah.
It's very, this is interesting. I just want to say this really quick. I was reading something else recently, and now I'm trying to remember what exactly got me on this, but this was like just a few days ago. And I got wound up in this, like, Wikipedia wormhole looking up something about the hangmen of England in the Nuremberg trials. And there's, like, apparently it was a family of hangmen. It was like a family tradition Their name was Pierpoint or Pierpoint. It's spelled Pierpoint. And it was like a guy and his brother and one of their sons. And they all had this job. And they were responsible for, I think, hanging the last woman hanged in the UK was a big case. That's what I was reading about. It was really interesting, like, to me, like, to think that, like, somebody's got to have this job. You got to do it a certain way, and you have to be trained for it. So
I think I stumbled across either that same page or something very similar, because I was trying to figure out, I think there was another particular case that, because it was, that was the last one, which was probably a decade after this. Mm-hmm. And then as of when this movie was made, the parents had passed, but the family, the sister Iris, was still fighting to get Derek Bentley like posthumously pardoned. And then that ended up happening 7 or 8 years after the film came out. But so I'm trying to like figure out that timeline of like when capital punishment was abolished in the UK. And then I came across this page that was like, you know, here are the last executions, and then here are the last executioners. And I'm like, wait, that's known?
Right.
Because here there's such like, you know, this is a bloodthirsty nation, but at the same time, we know the shit is not right, so nobody's right. putting their name on it. And we make sure no one exactly knows who's responsible. Ugh.
Yeah, it's really wild.
And the there was a picture on the page that I went to, and the dude looked like Fred from Call the Midwife.
Yes, I'm sure. I think it was the same. Oh, I'll try to find it.
Yeah. It was like the Mary hanging Pierpont. Oh, dear.
Right.
Well, yeah. I mean, it's not cheery. Let him have it. But it's actually, it's so much more and different from what I was expecting that I recommend it. I think it's worth the $3 to rent it.
Yeah.
Do you agree?
Yes. I thought it was very good.
Well, I'm glad that we've had kind of a middling run around here lately. I feel like I've been apologizing to guests a lot for what I've put them through. So I'm glad we got some like solid A-minus material for you.
Yeah, so some quality stuff.
Yeah. All right. Good for me.
Yes, congratulations.
Good, thank you. Good for us all. Speaking of good for us all.
In local news today, bees.
Allison, where else can listeners find you?
You can find me every once in a while right now at MHC Choice, which is another streaming service, not unlike BritBox. And you can download it the same way on your smart TV or your computer, whatever.
But it's like Eurobox, right?
Yeah, it's all it's all subtitled, but it has such good stuff on it. Like some of the stuff, like if you want to see how they handle these same kind of murder cases in like Finland, which you do, you can see it there, and the subtitling is really good. It's not an issue, but I write for them sometimes on some of their stuff, and I highly recommend it.
As do I. Thank you so much for coming back.
Thank you.
Coming up on The Blotter Presents, Jessica Lee's on the net Last Narc, and then I take a week off, and then Margaret Howie talks about Quiz, and then Marsha Chatelain is back to talk about Dirty, Rotten, John, Ugly Betty, or whatever the hell that thing is called. It's Amanda Peet as Betty Broderick is the point. Here's another point. If you've got a tip for The Blotter Presents, please find me on social media, Blotter Presents on Twitter and Instagram, and in the Best Evidence newsletter, bestevidence.fyi. Today's episode was sponsored by Best Fiends and Feels. Don't forget that 50% off promo code feels.com/blotter. My guest has been Allison Lohuff, and she is on Twitter at Lohuff. I'm Sarah D. Bunting, and I confidentially inform you that I hope you'll tune in next time.